have sabr for this. When on one side Hussein was attacking, on the other side the Kufan horses were coming. And as the horses collided with one another, on the ground was young Qasim. Young Qasim was on the ground under the hooves of these horses. When the dust finally settled, Imam al-Hussein looks on the ground. The narrator said the legs of Qasim were trembling. Imam looks at Qasim. He says something heart-wrenching. He says, "Azza wallahi ala ammik." He says, "This is very hard for me, O Qasim. This is very hard for me, Qasim." He says, "You called your uncle, but he did not respond in time. And when he responded, he could not help you. And when he tried to help you, it was too late to help you." Ah, the heart of Hussein. Cry for the heart of Hussein. It has been cut to pieces on the day of Ashura. He says, "I tried to help you, but it was too late to help you." Imam alayhi salam, the narrators give very descriptive maqtal of Qasim. You know, it says that Imam took the body of Qasim and he took him from his chest and placed it on his chest. And the narrators say that he began to walk towards the khaymah. And the feet of Qasim were dragging behind. Imam alayhi salam takes him back to the khaymah of the shuhada. He places his body next to the shuhada. He places it next to his son Ali ibn al-Akbar. And then he says to them, "Sabr, sabr, my children. Sabr, oh the son of my brother. Indeed, after this day, you will not feel any more difficulty."
I swear to Allah, whenever I face troubles in my life, I close my eyes and see your shrine and call the back every time. Oh, Hussein, you're the love of my heart. You are the light of my eyes. I swear to Allah, until my last breath, I will remember Hussein.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the expansion of bilateral ties between Iran and Bangladesh in line with the Ebrahim Raisi government's neighborhood first policy. And we shall also take a look at how the toxic wave of Islamophobia continues to haunt Indian Muslims, preventing Muslim women from securing jobs and livelihood.
The 20th ministerial meeting of the developing eight countries, which includes the Islamic Republic of Iran, was hosted by Bangladesh this week. The meeting, focusing primarily on food and energy security, tourism and trade, provided an opportunity for Tehran and Dhaka to revitalize their relations and broaden the scope of their economic and cultural cooperation. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian's discussions with Bangladeshi officials were in line with the Iranian government's policy of expanding cooperation with countries in the region.
Foreign Minister Amir Abdollahian's virtual address to the D8 summit was timed well, at a time when the Ebrahim Raisi government is looking to boost relations with regional countries in line with its neighborhood-first policy. Given the scope that exists between Iran and Bangladesh for expansion of cooperation in various spheres, the top Iranian diplomat used the opportunity to call for cooperation between developing countries and creation of an efficient economic system. The two countries have made strenuous efforts in recent years to take their traditional relations to a higher level. In a congratulatory message to his Bangladeshi counterpart on the country's Independence Day on March 26, President Raisi said the amicable relations between Iran and Bangladesh should be developed and deepened further. He expressed hope that the two countries will witness greater cooperation and collaboration in areas of mutual interest. While Iran and Bangladesh share time-tested cultural relations, they have also made efforts in recent years to boost their trade and economic cooperation. In July 2006, the two countries signed a preferential trade accord, but its activation was severely affected by U.S. sanctions on Iran. Iranian officials have often noted the unsatisfactory level of trade cooperation between the two sides, expressing readiness to engage deeply and sincerely.
Relations between Iran and Bangladesh go back centuries when it was still known as Bengal. However, since Bangladesh's independence in 1971, relations between the two countries have largely ebbed and flowed. From initial frostiness due to Iran's strong ties with Pakistan to Dhaka and Tehran becoming close allies, the two sides have come a long way. In recent years, with Dhaka showing particular interest in developing strategic ties with Middle Eastern nations, the attention has gradually shifted to its relationship with Iran, a key regional player.
Iran's relations with Bangladesh date back to the 14th century, when it was a sovereign state that encompassed present-day Bangladesh, the Indian state of West Bengal, and the Burmese state of Rakhine. Iranian immigrants played a key role in the Sultanate, as Persian was the official language. Over the centuries, Bengal witnessed a massive influx of Iranian scholars, lawyers, teachers, and clerics in search of employment, as well as to propagate Islam. Politically, in the early 1970s, after a few years of frostiness in bilateral ties, relations between Tehran and Dhaka improved after Iran recognized Bangladesh. Pakistan recognized the country in 1974 ahead of the second OIC summit in Lahore, which was followed by Iran and Turkey. The relations particularly improved after the Islamic Revolution in 1979. In 2007, Iran assisted Bangladesh with aid after the country was hit by Cyclone Sidr. Iran has also served as a key partner in developing Bangladeshi oil fields in the northeastern region of Sylhet. It has also offered to rebuild the country's sole state-owned oil refinery, Eastern Refinery, which was constructed in 1963 with Iran's help. In terms of bilateral trade, Iran can buy jute, ready-made garments, leather goods, tea, and agricultural products from Bangladesh, while it can export oil, natural gas, petrochemicals, plastics, and ceramics.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Bhattacharjee, journalist and author from India. He has been a foreign affairs writer for close to two decades and has reported on Bangladesh on multiple occasions. Now, Mr. Bhattacharjee, first of all, welcome to the program. Now, how significant do you see Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian's virtual participation in the context of efforts by Tehran and Dhaka to revitalize their bilateral relations?
Well, you have to really put the visit in the coming context of the visit of the D8 ministerial meeting that is going to take place in Dhaka. And this is a meeting which is coming at a crucial time when the world is more or less waking up to the importance of Bangladesh as a stabilizing factor in a world where the forces of disruption are at work. So this is a very critical moment, and this is also a moment of recognition of the importance of Bangladesh, and this is a symbolic moment in the sense that Bangladesh is more or less being welcomed for the initiatives that it is taking at home, whether be in the field of connectivity or in the field of greater law and order actions against you know, extremism and terrorism that are getting a lot of support from neighboring countries like India. So I would say that in the larger context of regional as well as in a global developments, I would say the visit is coming at a time when both sides may have substantial issues on the table.
Sir, as we know, Iran and Bangladesh have shared traditional cultural ties. So my question is, why have the two countries not been able to exploit the full potential of their trade and economic cooperation?
Well, the answer to begin with is that stars previously probably were not aligned to help the two countries come closer. As you know very well, in today's world, even strictly bilateral relations are also supported and facilitated sometimes because of regional and global developments. And the two countries are coming together at a time when the world is more or less in a phase of post-pandemic recovery. And of course, you know, the world is also dealing with the post-Ukraine war disruption of commodities, which is being described as the period of commodity shock. So both Iran and Bangladesh are important players at a time when the world is going through these seismic changes. And therefore, I would say that now it appears that the stars are aligned, because you have to remember that Russia is an important player in this period. And both the countries, that is Dhaka as well as Tehran, the two capitals of Iran and Bangladesh, are close partners of Russia. And you remember that the Nuripur nuclear power reactor that Russia is building in Bangladesh is one of the largest nuclear power projects that Russia is building anywhere in the world. And this power project is likely to be completed in the next 1 and 1.5 years. So just like, you know, Iran, which has benefited from the nuclear energy of Russia, you have now Bangladesh getting on the same boat. And Bangladesh is, of course, getting on that boat because of its very, very steep energy requirement. So I would say that there is also the Russian factor, which is bringing the two sides closer. And then, of course, you know, Iran has its troubled relationship with the West, with the United States. And Sheikh Hasina's government in the last few weeks has seen several ups and downs with the Western countries that are increasing pressure on Bangladesh because of democracy, human rights, and freedom of expression. And Sheikh Hasina herself has made certain comments that have indicated that the Prime Minister is probably looking for new partners. And if that be the case, then perhaps I would say that truly the stars are better aligned this time to bring the two countries together.
So you think the time is right for Tehran and Dhaka to reactivate their preferential trade agreement, which has been put on the back burner due to U.S. sanctions?
Well, you have to really look at trade in the present critical condition of the disruption that the world economy is undergoing. And I think the preferential trade agreement needs to be forward-looking, especially because it was the product of a particular age when things were very different from what it is at present. You know, the Russians were not assertive back then, and they are assertive right now. So the world's market has changed dramatically. So you'll have to really reorient it and look at the future requirements of both sides, and then move ahead and create a preferential trade agreement that will serve both sides, rather than just going back to the trade agreement and trying to restart it in its original form. I think the two countries really need to come on board because of the energy requirement that Bangladesh at present has, because Bangladesh is going through an acute phase of energy crisis that it needs to deal with at an emergency basis. So I think Iran can help Bangladesh considerably on that front, and Bangladesh can provide some critical diplomatic support at the United Nations and in other fronts. And I think it can be a good win-win situation for both sides.
Mr. Bhattacharjee, thank you for being on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
In a tweet, Iran's foreign ministry quotes the country's top diplomat, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, telling the D8 summit in Bangladesh that economic diplomacy and closer ties with neighboring countries are two of Iran's foreign policy priorities. Salahuddin Ri, a Dhaka-based economic analyst, says the organization of D8 countries today has the trade potential of $500 billion, marking a six-fold jump from 2017, when it stood at around $15 billion. Bangladeshi journalist Masood Karim notes that with a combined population of more than 1.1 billion people from eight developing economies of the Muslim world, D8 is a unique cross-regional intergovernmental organization stretching from Southeast Asia to Africa.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
The growing tide of Hindu nationalism and toxic Islamophobia has dangerously manifested in India under the present ruling dispensation, with a tsunami of hate speeches, attacks on religious places, desecration of religious symbols, and abuse of religious freedom. It's become an open season against Muslims in the world's largest democracy. Now, according to reports, serious obstacles have emerged in the way of Muslim women in the private sector market in India, with rampant discrimination and racism preventing them from landing jobs.
Each day brings new challenges for minority Muslims in Hindu-majority India as the country slowly slides toward Hindu-majoritarianism. Islamophobia in India enables violence, hate, subjugation, intimidation, and blatant discrimination against Muslims, who make up roughly 15% of the country's 1.35 billion population.
This Islamophobic sarkar is trying to deny our right. We want our right and freedom. And we will fight for our last minute of our life. And this is for us, and this is for our community, and this is for our all Indian citizens, citizenship right.
A recent study by Led By Foundation, a leadership incubator for India's most disadvantaged women, reveals serious impediments for Muslim women in securing jobs in the country's burgeoning private sector. The research found that for every two callbacks that a Hindu woman receives from private sector firms, a Muslim woman gets only one. According to the study, the net discrimination rate of 47.1% for Indian Muslim women compared to Hindu women proves the significant hiring bias and prejudice against Indian Muslim women across industries and geographies. The damning report reveals how the Muslim community, especially Muslim women, continues to be underrepresented in the formal job market. The report comes in the wake of calls for an economic boycott of Muslim vendors, daily wagers, craftsmen, and other service providers by fanatics associated with the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party. It shows that recruiters think of Muslim women as less capable of jobs that they are fully qualified for.
India's minority Muslim community has encountered decades of discrimination and racism, which has assumed alarming proportions under Narendra Modi's Hindu nationalist BJP government in the last 8 years. Under Modi, Muslims have been othered and reduced to second-class citizens. As per conservative estimates, around 80% of India's Muslim population today comprises Pasmanda, a Persian word for those left out. These people lag behind on economic, social, and political parameters, with no voice, no representation, and no agency.
The Hindu nationalist BJP has been accused of not giving adequate representation to Muslims in India. Notably, the party now has no Muslim among its 395 members of parliament after the term of former minister Mukhtar Abbas Naqvi ended in early July. Lack of representation and opportunities, though, isn't limited to politics. The malaise permeates all sectors of the public and private sectors. It also isn't an issue that pertains only to men. Women have been equally dispossessed and driven out of different spheres where they have had the opportunity to excel. Muslim women have also been at the receiving end for asserting their identity and freedom of choice. They have been forced to give up hijab. They have been auctioned online. They have been denied jobs. They have been put in jails. Their houses have been bulldozed. Yet they have stood firm and refused to be bullied or intimidated. The lack of representation in the job sector, as revealed by the Led By Foundation study, is another eye-opener. It says the overall participation of Muslims in union government departments is abysmally low at all levels. It also adds that the unemployment of Muslims in universities, banks, and public sector undertakings is also low.
Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by Mrs. Mirali, the editor of the Longview magazine from London, UK. First of all, welcome to the program, Mrs. Mirali. Now, according to a report, serious impediments have been created for Muslim women in India in securing public and private sector jobs. Now, do you see it as part of a toxic wave of Islamophobia and racism?
There are really long-standing problems in India with regard to, amongst other things, gender issues and the treatment of minorities. And what we see here is the continued coalescence of the two with regard to Muslim women. So, yes, there is definitely a toxic wave of Islamophobia, a very strong vein of it, current of it, running through India at the moment. But this is not particularly a recent thing. So it's part and parcel of it, but there are many other aspects to it. And I would say, arguably, that this is has got much longer and deeper roots.
Mr. Mirali, now under the Narendra Modi government in India, Muslims have been othered and virtually left out of the system. So could we say that this has damaged the country's rich secular democratic fabric?
So I have some issues with the framing of India as having a rich secular democratic fabric. I know this is a great idea that's been promoted for a long time, but really, as we've discussed before and in other places, there have been a lot of deep-rooted problems, communitarian problems, sectarian problems, problems of racism, and of which Islamophobia is just one, in India since partition, since independence, that have never been looked at, that have just simply been allowed to ossify at the social level and are completely embedded within the structures and systems of the Indian state. So, yes, there has been more damage under the BJP, but the BJP themselves are an outcome of this system. You know, they're not something that ran counter to it. They're very much a product of it. And until we really disentangle this, until people within India and outside of India start really discussing some of these problems, which are in some ways not even just India specific, they are to do with the post-colonial settlements around the world, particularly from the British Empire, but not only that, we're not going to get progress. We're going to keep seeing repeat cycles of extreme violence, extreme racism, extreme Islamophobia, and then a normalization settling down of some lower levels of discrimination, Islamophobia, and then another spike, and so on and so forth.
Last but not least, Miss, how has India changed over the past 8 years of the BJP government, and where do you see the country 10 years down the line?
You get now very openly, blatantly discriminatory laws and policies. I think this is one of the key differences. Whereas before, you may have more subtle forms of exclusion and marginalization and otherization, and I use the word subtle in inverted commas. What you now have is a kind of blatant call to aggression against Muslims. So you will see that high-ranking politicians, people within those networks of the BJP, and to be honest, even other political parties kind of in their wider networks, are being caught out, making extraordinarily violent speeches, claims against Muslims. You have endless conversations now trending about the justifications of cracking down on Muslims, discriminating against Muslims, even killing Muslims because on XYZ spurious basis, you know, things like fictions like Love Jihad, where there's a claim that Muslim men are going around seducing Hindu women and getting them converted to Islam. And these kind of what you can only describe as ridiculous narratives, which are then being used to justify these attitudinal changes in society, which again then means that more laws can be changed, more policies can be enacted. And what you have is then a distraction from the big problems that face India, the kind of increasing issues around wealth redistribution, about the way it has industrialized and the economy has grown in some ways, but then still left people in abject poverty, the decimation of the agricultural sector, etc. And none of these are being looked at. So what we get now is a kind of catastrophic collapse within India of both the economic and social fabric. This is very much kind of accelerated under the BJP, but at the same time has been masked by these kind of very rabid rhetorics and narratives. I don't want to be prophesying any kind of doom and gloom. I'm a believer and I pray and I hope that things in 10 years' time will be for the better.
On that note, I would like to thank Mrs. Mirali for her precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
The Bridge Initiative, a project to counter Islamophobia at Georgetown University, asserts that Islamophobia in India has corroded what was once the world's largest democracy, with laws that once belonged to South Africa's apartheid now popping up across the South Asian country. Samiullah Khan, a journalist and human rights activist, cites the mob lynching case of an 18-year-old Muslim youth who was killed by extremist Hindus in the southern Indian state of Karnataka to stress that the tide of Islamophobia is rising in India. Law professor and author Khaled Beydoun says Hindutva leaders are paying women to frame Muslim businessmen in rape cases, targeting prominent business and community leaders, calling it another vile dimension of Islamophobia in India.
And that was our episode about Iran's growing ties with Bangladesh and the grave problem of Islamophobia in India. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you because you are...
A Muslim lady. You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, my very dear sisters, welcome to Muslim Lady. The month of Muharram is already there, so I offer my condolences to every single one of you and, of course, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, in order to broaden your insight. So today, since it is Muharram, we are going to have some discussion upon the women who participated in the story that created Muharram, actually. This is Asma, your humble host, and here with me I have my very dear sister, Sister Sadiqah. Assalamu alaikum, sister, and welcome to Muslim Lady.
Wa alaikum salam, and thank you so much for having me. It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
Of course, same in here. Okay, dear ladies, today we are going to talk about the role of women in the battlefield of Karbala and in the journey of Imam Hussein alayhi salam in his way to teach us the truth of Islam that has been so much deviated from its true path. And also, we are going to look at the very comparison between the mother and the daughter and what they shared and contributed to the improvement, or just let's say to help the imam of their time. So, sister, let's start with the role of Lady Zainab in the journey of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So in the previous session, we talked a lot about the fact that women were carried with Imam in order to be the witness of this incident, of this great event that happened in the history of Islam, and also in order for them to be the narrator of this history. And then we got to the point that Lady Zainab in Damascus, she had some lectures and sermons that affected many people and enlightened them as well, and actually led to the downfall of Bani Umayyah. Now, shall we just continue on that point?
So Lady Zainab, as we know, is the daughter of Imam Ali and Hazrat Fatima, and she's also the sister of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Mm-hmm. So Lady Zainab alayhi salam, from a very young age, she saw what her mother Hazrat Fatima had to do to protect the wilaya of Imam Ali alayhi salam,
or
in other terms, the imamate of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So according to history, there was an oath of allegiance that was taken on the day of Ghadir. But then as soon as the Prophet died, there were a few individuals who took the caliphate and they denied Imam Ali alayhi salam the caliphate.
Yeah.
So Hazrat Fatima alayhi salam, in that instance, she drew on all the political situation of the time, and she goes into the court of the caliph at that time, which was the masjid, which was the mosque.
Yeah.
Right? The mosque of the Prophet was a place where all the important matters used to take place. Now, according to one of the authors, I believe his name is Shahid Baqir al-Sadr, he's written a very interesting book looking into this specific event.
Who actually was an Islamic scholar.
He's an Islamic scholar, and he's not Shahid because he was killed in a very brutal manner because of his Islamic views.
Yeah.
And he was killed by Saddam Hussein, I believe.
Yes, and he was a very important figure.
Very important figure who's written many, many great books that are still studied. So when he looks at this event, he says Hazrat Fatima walked, her house was actually connected to the mosque.
Yeah.
Her door was open into the mosque.
The Prophet made it that way.
Yes, according to the verse of the Quran.
Yes, according
But what she does is that day, she doesn't go from her house into the mosque. She takes another route. She walks out from the other door into the main road and then enters from another mosque to collect attention of the people. She doesn't go alone. She goes with a group of women who protect her.
Okay, dear audience, welcome back to Muslim Lady. We're talking about the whole story of Karbala and the role of women in participating in this battlefield.
She goes into the court in front of the caliph and delivers a whole sermon. And it's a very long sermon. It's
a great message, actually.
Exactly. It's a very long sermon that looks at the different Islamic principles. But when we come to the crux of it, she draws on the political time. She talks to them about how her husband had been chosen and what different services he had given to Islam, because these people had drawn on the caliphate on the basis that they had migrated with the Prophet. Therefore, they were very close to the Prophet. Therefore, they deserved to be Prophet.
Yeah.
Therefore, they deserved to have caliphate. So drawing on that same argument of theirs, she says, well, my husband has more virtues, right? Mm-hmm. Now, apart from this sermon only, she had other roles as well in advancing the imamate of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Yes.
So we know that in the night for 40 days...
And actually in shedding light on the truth.
Exactly. So we know that, according to history, we know that up to 40 days she went to the houses of the companions with her husband and her two sons and asked them, did you not give the oath of allegiance on the day of Ghadir, why have you turned back? And these people, like we mentioned, the people of Kufa, there's a similarity. They deny it. They say, if you would have come to us before the other caliph, we would have given you the oath of allegiance, yes, but we've already given it to someone else. So they're turning back on the oath of allegiance. Now we compare it to Kufa. They write letters to Imam Hussein, and then they turn back and say, but we didn't write any letters to you. What are you saying?
Yeah.
Right? So understanding the political circumstance was so important. You see, women are often understood as people who have to have household chores, take care of children. Yes, please do take care of your child. The child needs to be nurtured by you. But don't forget that you need to understand, because when it comes to the imam, there is no man and woman.
Exactly, yes.
You have an equal role in defending the imam. You might not need to go to the battlefield, but if it comes to supporting him with your tongue and your work, you have to do it.
And maybe they could even enlighten their husbands.
Exactly. And this is what Hazrat Fatima did. This was a very good point you mentioned. When she was on her deathbed, the women of Medina come to her and she delivers another sermon to them, explaining to them that what their husbands have done is wrong. It's a very nice sermon. Everything is available. There's actually a book that's been translated into English, Lady Fatima from Cradle to Grave, available in English. It's been translated by Sheikh Tahir Ridha Jafar as well. So if anyone wants to Google it, it's available in PDF. I have checked it as well. And it has all these sermons inside it.
Thank you for sharing that.
So she talks to these women. Now, these women were not aware of the political circumstances. So when they hear the sermon of Hazrat Fatima, they go back and they beat their husbands up over it. Why did you leave the daughter of the Prophet?
Yeah.
So the role of the woman here. Now let's go to Karbala.
Exactly.
Hazrat Zainab, she's seen everything, right? She's seen how her mother has been able. So there's a book that's written by...
So as the mother is the daughter.
The daughter. She continues what her mother started in defending imamate.
Yeah, and she finishes that.
She finishes it. Now there's a book written by Anita Rai.
Yeah.
She's an author. She's written many novels, but towards the last few years that I have been following her, she's written a lot of historical books about the life of the Prophet. But there is one book that she's written, The Essential Woman, that compares Hazrat Zainab and Hazrat Fatima. And here she tries to compare the role of these two great women and how they complement each other, and how the daughter took on a lot from the mother in defending imamate. Like when Hazrat Fatima was in the mosque defending the imamate of Imam Ali alayhi salam, she proves to them, and in the other historical instances, like going to the houses of the companions and asking them why they withdrew the oath of allegiance from Imam Ali alayhi salam, thus invalidating the caliphate that had taken seat.
Yeah.
Hazrat Zainab goes into the court of Yazid and she refers to him as Tulaqa. And she tells them, Antum Tulaqa, you are those people who were freed by my grandfather and you have no right to his seat in caliphate.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
If we go back to history, when the conquest of Mecca happened, those who did not accept Islam up till that day, they were, in other terms, freed by the Prophet. They were told that they will not, their blood will not be shed. They're free to live by the Muslims.
Yeah.
They accepted Islam because the Prophet was the caliph at the time. He did have governorship over that time. It was agreed that these people who were freed on the day of the conquest of Mecca would not be allowed to take caliphate ever. One of those who was freed was Muawiyah, the father of Yazid.
Yeah.
Muawiyah still did go on to take on caliphate, but Yazid did go as
and
well.
And she makes that clear for
she
people.
She makes it very clear for the people over there that you have no right, Yazid, you have no right to take the seat because you are those people who are freed by my grandfather.
Yeah.
And by the law that we had established and everyone had agreed to, your caliphate is invalid. Based on what has happened in the past, because you
exactly.
people are the ones who fought against the Muslims while you're now residing over the Muslims. How does that make sense?
So now we can see that as a woman, she becomes the leader of this journey.
Exactly.
She starts to lead everyone, to be the one who brings enlightenment to people's head.
Yes. Then when we see how Hazrat Fatima defended Imam Ali alayhi salam, we know that the door was struck on her. We know that she was whipped when she was holding onto his cloth when they were trying to drag him away. Now we go to Karbala. Imam Hussein is in his last breaths. He's in the state of sajda. Shimar is there. He's going to kill him. Hazrat Zainab runs out of her tent. And she addresses one of the army leaders. I believe his name was Ubaidullah. And he actually did not want to come to the war. Yeah. He had tried ways to find, but it was his love for wealth and his love for leadership that brought him there. And she tells him, are you going to stand there while the son of the prophet is being killed?
That's very sorrowful.
And she goes over there and she tries to protect him. And they whip her before Imam Hussein realizes, because, you know, he's in his last breath. He has not had water. He's very... According to some, he's moving in and out of consciousness, according to some. In that, she goes to try and defend him. And when he regains consciousness, he tells us to go back. So Hazrat Fatima in Medina was defending Imam Ali. Hazrat Zainab seen the role of her mother in Medina.
Yeah.
And she assumes the same role when it goes to defending the Imam of her time. And we see throughout her journey from Karbala to Damascus and back to Medina, she was defending the next Imam. And inshallah, that can be discussed at a later.
Yeah, and also we saw that the role of a mother in Islamic heritage is that she would nurture kids like her.
Exactly.
So that they would lead the entire journey.
And this is what Hazrat Fatima did perfectly.
Exactly, yeah. Thank you, sister. We used all the information you shared with us. Thank you for that. And thank you for mentioning the name of the books. And thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us. Until another session, I bid you farewell.
Who is the lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. To Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah, Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
My name is Sheikh Zayed Al Salami.
A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih Al Hayat, written by Ayatollah Al Uzma Al Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. How we are able to understand our daily routine as far as our relationship with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and how we are able to not only attain sustenance and rizq, but also benefit on a spiritual, social, and moral level. The same way that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Holy Quran mentions that He has divided the year into the Hijri year into 12 months, the same way as He has appointed certain times as holy, like Layal al-Qadr, for example. The same process of Almighty God allocating certain individuals and certain pieces of land on this earth as holy. We also understand that as far as our daily routine is concerned, it's important for us to find ways of improving the quality of that particular day. Some cases I've had to convince people to stay away from parties on Laylatu Ashura, on Laylatu Tasu'a, on Arba'een of Imam Hussein Salamullahi Alayhi. It's very surprising. Yes, I understand, you know, on Eid al-Fitr, on Eid al-Adha, on Eid al-Ghadir, you might have to work. You might have to work. But what are you substituting for that, you know? Are you able to, you know, go in a little bit late to work? Are you able to leave work a little bit early? You know, are you able to, when you sign up for that job, to say to them, you know what, I've got 4 days in the year, I'll take them from my holiday or my leave, and these 4 or 5 days in the year, I, under no circumstance, am I able to work. You know, have some kind of agreement, some kind of arrangement. And this can only be done if you are foreplanning. You're making your whole yearly schedule in advance so you benefit the most highest level of benefit from these occasions, whether they be doing good or whether they be staying away from doing something bad. The same way as there is a cause and effect relationship between sin and your soul, there's also a cause and effect relationship with nature, with your surroundings, with the universe. We do believe in, if I could say, you know, good and bad kind of omen, if I could call it that, in the sense that there are times where good things should be done, and there are times where you should avoid doing certain things. Even as far as intimacy with one's spouse, you need to be observant of when you do it and at what time, especially for the sake of conceiving a child. You need to make sure, my dear brothers and sisters, that when you want to have a child, you must plan. Planning to conceive a child means choosing the best time, observing all of the adab and everything else. All that I've said, please also bear in mind that not anything that is bad that happens to you means that there is nahs or bad omen. Not anything that happens to you means you have a jinn, or someone's done black magic on you, or there's hasad, or there's evil eye, or all these other things that unfortunately some people usually say. That's also a wrong and negative attitude for a person to have.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
There's this hadith from Imam As-Sadiq Salamullahi Alayhi where it says that there are certain days where it would be blessed, it would be Mubarak, if you start your job, if you start your work during the Hijri month, the 1st, 2nd, 6th, 7th, 9th, 14th, 18th, 19th, 20th, 22nd, 23rd, 27th, 28th, and 29th of every Qamari Hijri month. What happens if you want to start work or if you want to do something outside of these times? In riwayat from Ahlul Bayt alayhi wa salam, it says, pay sadaqah and go ahead. If you have to, for example, work on the third day, for example, here it says, third day, you shouldn't start work. If you have to work on the third Hijri day, pay sadaqah and go ahead. قُلْتُ لِأَبِي عَبْدِ اللَّهِ حَمَّادِ بْنَ عُثْمَانِ He says, قُلْ I ask Abu Abdullah, Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, salamullahi alayhi, is it makruh for a person to travel in certain days like Wednesday and other days? Imam al-Sadiq, salamullahi alayhi, he says, اِفْتَحْ سَفَرَكَ Start your trip بِالصَّدَقَةِ with paying sadaqah وَقَرَأْ آيَةُ الْكُرْسِي and recite آيَةُ الْكُرْسِي وَأَخْرِجْ إِذَا بَدَى لَكَ and then leave if you have to tasaddaq wakhruj ayya yawmin shi't. Another hadith says, Imam al-Sadiq salamullahi alayhi, he says, if you were to start your day with paying sadaqah, man tasaddaqa bi sadaqatin, idha asbah, starting your day early in the morning, dafa'a Allah azza wa jal anhu nahs dhalika al-yawm, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will repel, will keep away the bad omen, the nahs of that day from you. And there are many of these kind of ahadith that speak about, you know, how to stay away from nahs or sa'atu nahs and these kind of issues. Important thing is, here there is a necessity, an akhlaqi necessity in our adab in Islam for you to continue to pay sadaqah and do dua before you pay sadaqah, do dua after you pay sadaqah. Whatever you do, even when it comes to your whole, this whole process of working and wanting to do something for that day, you know, have some kind of policy. Let's say I work 20 days in a month. 3 of these days, the income for 3 of these days, I'm going to give as charity. I'm going to give to the masjid. I'm going to give for Imam Hussein. I'm going to have majalis of Imam Hussein. Whatever, like any kind of idea, I want to contribute to a sadaqah jariyah. You know, that means that you are working really as a mujahid. We will continue on in our next episode. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children scream.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
Hidden Files.
Well, there's a distinct and qualitative difference between one breaking a law for one's own individual self-interest or violating it in the interests of a class or a people whose oppression is expressed either directly are indirectly through that particular law. Well, the former might be called a criminal, though in many instances he is a victim. But the latter, as a reformist or revolutionary, is interested in universal social change. Captured, he or she is a political prisoner. Well, this is an excerpt from writings by former political prisoner, black revolutionary activist and professor, Dr. Angela Davis. Hello, and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Well, you heard the definition of who is a political prisoner, according to this philosopher and activist. But the United States denies ever having any political prisoners. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of individuals who've been incarcerated in the U.S. over the decades who would say otherwise. Now, some of them have now died in prison. Some have been released, and